Well, I'm faced with a panicky situation of anyone introducing the keynote speaker room. I can't figure out where the heck he is. But I'm hoping he's still there.
Did anyone else put their hand up?
Too bad. I was all set to take on. First, before we get to the speech, I just would like to thank the people who put the program together, and it's going to be a wonderful program over the next 2 days, and I know you've had a wonderful time today. I will apologize for the air conditioning being off on the only warm days that we've ever had in Vancouver for the last, I don't know how long. But I hope, nevertheless, that you will find it as stimulating as I know I am going to. The planning committee consisted of Peter Arthur, Chen-Ying Chang, Mark Jordan, MJ Sahonis, Rick Kopak, Rolly Lorimer, Heather Morrison, Alex Schmecker, and Richard Smith. And the conference co-directors were Brian Owen, Kevin Stranick, and John Alinsky. And I particularly want to thank the conference support team. If it seems to you things are relatively free-flowing and everything is working, it's due to them. They put together a wonderful kit. I know that they have spent a huge amount of time to make this an absolutely splendid conference. So thank you to all of you. And they include Carmen Larson from UBC and from SFU, Catherine Louie, Rochelle March and Marcia, Christine Manzer, Angela Rash, and Carmel Richter. So thank you very much. I think they deserve it. Now it is my very great pleasure to introduce our keynote speaker, John Alinsky. It is only fitting that he should deliver this speech. And I suspect that everybody in the room knows him and has heard him talk before. But I will quickly remind you that he has recently taken up a position as professor of education at Stanford University while still holding the Pacific Press Professor of Literacy and Technology at University of British Columbia, and we are delighted he will still be around here a good part of the time. He wrote a well-known book, The Access Principle, The Case for Open Access to Research and Scholarship, which has won 2 outstanding book awards. And much of his work is available for download from the Public Knowledge website, and he directs the PKP project at UBC and Stanford. John, I know you're about to jump up and start talking in your eloquent way, but before you do, I know that this is a conference about the Public Knowledge project, but we would be terribly remiss if we didn't talk about the fact that you are a person who, unlike many of us, has truly made a difference. I mean, this is a project that you conceived in terms of recognizing the importance of access to scholarly works and communication from areas other than North America and Europe, and you did something about it. And the software that was developed as part of that project and is continuing to be developed has truly made it possible for that to happen, for that to be improved. And I think we do owe you a debt of thanks. So thank you, and we look forward to what you have to say today.
Thank you very much, Lynn, and Mary Oakham's gone. The phrase that stuck in my mind, one of the phrases that stuck in my mind from Mario's brief introduction was the notion of scholars parking their egos at the door. And you're making that very difficult for me, Lynn. But I also have to say a few words in regard to that because of the SFU-UBC history of a slight rivalry, a slight intellectual rivalry. And so I need to put in a word or two, although Mario was very fair, I thought, in terms of this balanced representation of the two universities. But there is another institution in this town, and that rivalry has always been part of my academic career until Brian Owen, in fact. Where is Brian? Until Brian Owen made the switch to SFU as an associate librarian and came forward with the idea that we might work together. SFU has done work on open source software development long before I had the idea. and had been working with libraries on a kind of community service basis. And so we sat down and we formed what turned out to be an entirely, well, I'll be frank with you, illegal agreement. We formed a memorandum of understanding between the two institutions on a basis of trust, contribution, sharing, a kind of wealth of knowledge, only to be told 1 year later when we were about to raise our glasses to celebrate that it was an entirely, and I do recall this, and perhaps this does reflect on UBC because it did come forward from UBC's legal counsel that it was an illegal agreement. I thought immediately it was illegal because of the cooperation, the sharing of knowledge, the openness of exchange, but I felt that, at least I learned very quickly that that was not the case. It was illegal because I had signed the agreement. I had signed the agreement on behalf of an institution known as the University of British Columbia. And I had assumed that I had somehow the authority or the position, or the chutzpah, we might say, to sign on behalf of the University of British Columbia. So as soon as I acknowledged that, in fact, no, I am not, and there is no resemblance, the University of British Columbia is beautifully located on a lovely tract of land with gorgeous trees overlooking the ocean. No resemblance. And that any kind of pretension on my part, or any kind of presumption on my part, on representing the university was not my intent at all. The university then said, that's fine, but we want the intellectual property. That the university itself has a new interest, that the new economy of the institution today is all about this kind of claim on intellectual property. And fortunately, the Office of Technology Transfer at the University of British Columbia, which about 7 years before, after a long conversation with me, had declared that I, in fact, had no intellectual property of interest to the University of British Columbia. I made the person who interviewed me swear never to tell my dean that I had no intellectual property of any value to the University of British Columbia. Subsequently, that same office, though, saved, as it were, as a vegetarian and a Jew, saved our bacon. Because the Department of Technology Transfer at the University of British Columbia declared that if a professor has no intent to commercialize, if the professor has, in fact, a desire to see the software, the intellectual product, the work that they do, made public as part of an open source community in this case, that the university was prepared to respect that. That there was still within the university a kind of first principle. And for me, that was a refreshing element. And if there's any other defense I need to present, any other kind of introduction to the University of British Columbia, don't forget the trees and the beach. Did I mention that? If you didn't, Mario hasn't mentioned the beach yet, at least in his thoughts. So there is, that to me is the starting point. But let me do a few more introductory remarks because it is such a neat place. I mean, come on, people. I mean, I feel like recognizing the delegate from McGill University, formerly of Tennessee. So this is a wonderful place. I don't really know if it is a place for dialogue. I have to be frank with you. I have to be honest with you. I am not sure if you have to raise your hand, then push a button, wait for the red light to come on, and then keep making sure that there are not two other microphones or red lights on anywhere else in the room, but that is the most conducive. But it is such a neat room. And I don't know quite know where to stand, and I don't think it is a podium. I was going to work a room like Donahue, but someone came up to me and he said, are you going to be all over the place like Sting? Kind of a generational thing, although I thought Sting was my generation. So I will try to work the room a bit, and I want to work it around a number of themes. I know this conference is not necessarily about the public knowledge project, but it is entirely in the spirit of which this project began. And this is also kind of unusual for me because I don't know if you've noticed, I certainly noticed, that one of the things we didn't take care of, and people here at SFU, and I do owe them a huge debt, the organizing committee and the names that you heard, and I appreciate you reading them to the group because they are important people in this process, and this is about, for me at least, among the best organized conferences I have ever been to, and that's allowing for snow in Buenos Aires for the first time in 80 years, and layovers in Montreal, and people visiting the London airport for longer than they ever planned to or intended to. But among all of them, it has been superbly organized. The one thing we forgot to do, the one thing I forgot to do, was to give a title for the keynote. You notice there isn't a title for the keynote. And I'm kind of naked without a title, and I feel badly for not having a title, and I'm going to offer it a title. Because this is about the public knowledge project, and there's one thing this has allowed me to do, it is reflect on the history of this project. I'm not quite working the room yet, am I? To reflect on the history of this project, And so I would choose, and again, this is slightly in light of tomorrow night's entertainment, which no one has actually made a plug for yet, but I will. So the Public Knowledge Project essentially started 10 years ago, in 1997. And again, what is this history? I mean, these dates, I would like to go back actually to about 1966 for a moment or two. But 10 years ago, the Public Knowledge Project came forward as an idea. And it came forward as an idea of the notion of a project, not a center, not an institute, not a building, not a converted Woodward, so I think that sounds like a marvelous project, but a project, a kind of temporary thing, something that we could focus on and get done. We could look at scholarly publishing and the failure to have a global knowledge exchange that's at the very intent of scholarly publishing, and we could treat that as a project, and then we could say, time for something else. I can go back to my work in literature, in literacy. And I could look again at Shakespeare and Romeo and Juliet and the influence of feminist literary theory on those kinds of things, because my project would be done. I was a little naive. I didn't think it would be 10 years that we would still be working on it. But at least it gives me the advantage of having a title like 10 years after. Okay, there's only a few of you in the room that will appreciate the Alvin Lee-ness of 10 years after. We'll remember the scene in the Woodstock movie when the watermelon rolls onto the stage after 10 years after his performance. 10 years ago, I had the pleasure of going to Seattle University for a year to be the Boeing chair. And again, I parked my ego at the door, so I don't say that with any pride at all. I can in fact say with disappointment, because the Boeing chair at Seattle University, it's just the most ordinary little stool. You can't plug in. There's no TV on the back of the chair in front of you. The service is not so bad. I mean, there's virtually none. I mean, the fortunate part is there aren't six people sitting beside you in the Boeing chair. But Seattle University is a Jesuit university. And so there was a lovely kind of opportunity there to return to one of the scholarly academic traditions of the West and the Jesuit education. And at the same time, have the ability with the Boeing chair, as it were, to fly wherever I wanted. Actually, I couldn't fly anywhere, but to fly in an imaginative sense. But it was an unusual kind of position insofar as they said, come down for a year and do whatever you want. We don't care what you did before. Just come down for a year to Seattle. It was not far. It was still raining. I had the same, you know, they asked about the Gore-Tex. I had a complete set of Gore-Tex, which was probably what qualified me to teach there. And I had the opportunity then to think for a year about something I hadn't thought about. But of course, it was always, and it ended up to be things that I had thought about. So 10 years ago, I had thought about things that were changing in terms of the technology that Mario referred to. 10 years ago, the internet, of course, was with us. It had begun. Many of us had at least started to send emails in 1997 or 98. Many of us didn't start sending many emails. But at that point, I thought that there was a chance to do something around publishing. Now, my own background in publishing, I have to be clear about this, because actually I'm a professor of education. If I explain to people on a bus what I'm doing, I say that I teach teachers. And I do. My day job is to teach teachers, and in particular, teach teachers about language and literacy and literature, composition and writing, vocabulary, and the whole range of activities that we do with language. And out of all those activities, underneath all of that, is the history of publishing. And so that some years before, when I went to get my doctorate, this is a little bit of personal history here. When I went to get my doctorate, as a school teacher, I won a Teachers Federation, Teachers Union, Teachers Federation scholarship. Went to get my doctorate. I came back to my school district. My school district was so delighted that I had gone off to study a PhD, that I had taken the idea of learning so seriously that I had come back because the job situation wasn't that good in universities at the time, but actually I had come back to teach and to pay my board back, as it were, to St. Marie, Board of Education, and they said, we're so delighted that you've gone off to get a PhD. We have a wonderful opportunity for you. You can teach at the farthest outlying school in our district. It's a chance to see Algoma in the fall, which is a real treat for those of us who enjoy the color changes in the northern Ontario, to see the rivers and the lakes, see the towns and the communities every morning at 6:30, and every afternoon after buses had all left the school at 4:30. In the second year, they said, because you went off to get a PhD, we have another opportunity because we have a teacher surplus this year. You can travel from school to school for 2 weeks and do whatever you want. And what I ended up doing in those 2 weeks in visiting schools was the history of publishing. with students from grades 3 to grade 8. And I don't really know where this idea came from, but if I had 9 days with these students, what I wanted to do was to recapitulate the history of publishing, and we started the way I'm starting with you. We started with the power of the spoken word. We didn't start with PowerPoint. This is 1983, 84. We started with the power of the spoken word. And it has stayed with me in the sense that I would do this little game with students. I would talk to them about the power of oral publishing. I would say that there was a poet some years ago, many, many years ago, who didn't speak a language that is even a spoken language that isn't spoken today, who was blind and didn't write anything down, who traveled from village to village with his Stratocaster and would recite a poem of 12,000 lines, and then go to the next village and recite another poem, or perhaps the same poem of 12,000 lines. So we don't know this story. I would say to the students, I would begin to tell the students about the Trojan horse, and I would explain it to them, and all of a sudden the students would start putting their hands up in the air. I said, how is this possible? Do you speak ancient Greek? And they would say, and of course they'd probably be a student from private school, say yes. 3 years, how about you? And I would sort of bow out and say, no, the translations are excellent today, really. And so it's out of this history of publishing, and we took it in 19, I don't know if you remember 1984 at computers, in Sault Ste. Marie, the privilege I had when I was told I had to go on the road again and visit about 500 students across maybe 20 schools, they said, well, what can we do to make this a little better for you? I said, you can buy me a printer. So I had the only printer in the schools of Sault Ste. Marie and would arrive with my 1971 Dodge Dart with a printer in the trunk. And I would pull into the school, and I would take it up and ceremoniously walk into the school and plug it into the only Apple IIe that the school would have. And out of that experience of taking students from the history of publishing, from the very beginning when we would do oral poetry, and we would take that oral poetry from classroom to classroom in a kind of guerrilla poetry movement where we would break into the classrooms, march into the front of the room and start reciting our poems because we thought it was that important. Because we thought the notion of publication was so exciting because every student there imagined that if Homer could do it, not Homer Simpson, but if Homer, single name only, like Sting, if Homer could do it, then maybe they could. And then finally we ended up printing our poems on a computer. Now this is 1984. We didn't have word processing. We did at the end of the year, let's be honest. 1983, we didn't have word processing. 1984, we had, a Bank Street writer. Remember Bank Street writer? So by 1983, we had to program in the language. We had to do illustrations. I remember these. The illustrations we would do using the characters. So a brace bracket and an ampersand and a brace bracket, that would be a rose. And so we created a kind of poetry around this effort to publish. And so out of that history of publishing, and it was a great and kind of crazy year, the final year of my teaching, I had a job at the University of Calgary after that. Out of that sense of the excitement and enjoyment of the students, the funny thing that I want to tell you too was that this was a program in which I felt I had been crippled as a teacher because I was only in the school for 9 days and I wasn't allowed to give any marks to the students. And so I had this strange sense that this isn't going to work. I've never taught a student where there weren't marks involved. Where would be the incentive? What would it mean for students if they asked me at any point? I was always afraid the first day. How do we get marked for this? Is it on the recitation? Or is it on the number of lines I can deliver? And the interesting thing is, after 500 students, it came up maybe once or twice. And I was just able to say, the first few times I did it with students, after, say, 3 or 4 sessions of 9 days, I was able to say that, yeah, it's not an issue. If this is important to you, you'll do it, and if not, that's fine. You don't need to publish. You can just perish. Even children. People, you say that to adults. We would never say that to children. Please. So, this notion of publishing became a critical point for me in terms of this. I tried to think back in terms of my history where this publishing thing had been important before. And I just want to pay a brief tribute in terms of Canadian history to a magazine called Canadian Forum. Let's go back to 1966 when Canadian Forum was in its heyday. Well, you must remember the Canadian Forum. And anyone else? Don't be ashamed. Northrop Frye, Margaret Atwood cut their teeth on the Canadian Forum. The Canadian Forum was the serious literary, thought-provoking magazine without a cover. It was just typed from one end to the other.
And in 1966, I remember trading with a good friend of mine, Alan Garshowitz. We created a mock-up of our version in pencil of the Canadian Forum, thinking that we would take it forward. And in Sault Ste. Marie, we had the fortune, the good fortune in Sault Ste. Marie, of having a hotel called the Algonquin. And so we had this dream that we would meet at the Algonquin Hotel, which is a famous hotel in New York City, where the literary types, where Dorothy Parker talked about women who wore glasses and all sorts of funny little limericks, like their lines, excuse me, lines like that. And we thought we could recreate that kind of history. So that sense of being interested in books is and ideas is really about an interest in publishing, an interest in how ideas are shared and exchanged. But enough of the nostalgia, okay? I was trying to park my ego at the door when Mary was talking about that, and I really need to be stricter about it. 10 years ago, I finished a project called Learning to... I know, it's still about me. 10 years ago, I finished a project called Learning to Divide the World, a project about imperialism and education, the legacy of imperialism and education, a legacy that we had somehow imagined has disappeared after 5 centuries, a legacy that we thought in the 1960s, at the same time, perhaps not Sting, but the Beatles and the Rolling Stones, and 10 years after, Alvin Lee was getting started, the independence movement in Africa and Southeast Asia had ended imperialism, and that somehow we were beyond that. And in Learning to Divide the World, I realized, as far as I could go into subject areas like mathematics and science and English and history and geography, that the remnants of an imperial order were still being taught to children. And the primary metaphor that came out of that project for me was the notion of center, which is why I'm trying to get to the center, and periphery. That there has been, as part of the basic geometry of imperialism, a notion of a center and a periphery. And that periphery would always be at the edge and would not receive regular issues of journals, or would not receive, as it were, the same kind of access to participate. And that center and periphery, for me, became very focused in a particular area. Not just in what teachers were doing in schools, not just in the grade 12 biology textbook that was still teaching race by a series of identifying pictures with a couple of them wearing ties and nice suits and a couple of them bare-chested and rather scruffy looking. That center and periphery was so much a part of my own realm, that there were centers of publishing and there was a periphery that was receiving, as it were, some portion of that. 3 issues out of 4, 3 months after the initial publication, a reduced number, as the prices increased, a reduced number in terms of the circulation of journals. Some of the points that we heard discussed today in the Canadian Library Association meetings. So out of that sense of learning to divide the world, I realized that, in fact, that the legacy of imperialism here in British Columbia, perhaps where you're living as well, the legacy of imperialism was still with us, of course, as it might be after 5 centuries, as a way of thinking, that we needed particular projects. And at that point, I had the honor of working with the Vancouver Sun, which is a building that's just around on the other side of SFU. The Vancouver Sun, as part of an experiment with me, again, 10 years ago, said that we could partner. I am the Pacific Press Professor of Literacy and Technology, and that's always been kind of an oxymoron for me, the two notions of literacy and technology. The Pacific Press owns the two newspapers in town as part of the democratic tradition that stretches the only two newspapers in town, the only two English language major newspapers in town. That stretches back for a good number of, a couple of centuries at least. The Pacific Press decided that if it was giving me this money to be as part of an endowment, they would do an experiment. And the Vancouver Sun said, why don't we, I said to the Vancouver Sun, in fact, that they agreed, why don't we connect research and journalism? Why don't we reach the public in a different kind of way by providing access to research articles to readers of the newspaper? You have the readership. I have some of the backstory for that readership. And as part of that experiment, John Cruikshank and David Radler, I don't know if you know any of these names, David Radler and Conrad Black, they've been in the news recently, at that point owned the Vancouver Sun, and John Cruikshank is now at the Chicago Tribune as part of that tradition. They agreed to participate in this experiment, so we had the pleasure, in the early days of the Public Knowledge Project, of trying to assemble the research that would go behind the newspaper stories, in this case, a 6-day series on technology and education. How appropriate
that we could be able to provide this kind of background. This is still 1997-98, so the web is in place. We're going to put the information online. Readers are going to pick up their daily paper, sit down over their Starbucks coffee. They're going to open, 1997-98, sorry. Not most neighborhoods didn't have Starbucks coffee. There were still a few neighborhoods, I should say, that didn't have Starbucks available at their local cafe. They're also in their Vancouver Sun. They're going to read about the libraries and technology. Public libraries starting to acquire computers. Young women taking computer classes in growing numbers. And at the end of those articles, there would be a URL. There would be a link. And readers could click on that link, and they would come to a website where we would have the research, the evidence, the statistics about British Columbia and about the world. We would have alternative policies. We had an online forum where the Ministry of Education was prepared to engage in a discussion, with, as it were, with people reading the newspaper. We had researchers. Mary Bryson volunteered to be online and have her research about young women in computers read. And out of that experience, we had a fairly small participation. One day the newspaper printed the wrong URL. Pre-Google days, that's pretty disastrous. The other thing we learned about this was the pace at which journalism worked and the pace at which we worked. We asked for 6 weeks. We'd assembled a lot of research. We wanted to know what order it was going to go in and which days it was going to go in and how we could organize it. And they said, we don't make those decisions until midnight, until the night before. And this was a kind of a change for us. And grad students, it was fine. They were already just getting up at that time, and they didn't have any problem with that. But for a faculty member, it was kind of a shock. That at midnight, we would learn they had changed the story. They needed to reassemble some of the research. But the real shock, the real embarrassing part, the part I hadn't realized going into this, was that I couldn't deliver. The newspaper, the journalist, Janice Steppenhagen, still working at the Vancouver Sun, wonderful education reporter, found children to interview, found parents who were concerned, found teachers who cared or didn't care about the use of technology. All I had to do was to find the studies and make them available to people. And I couldn't deliver. I could get titles, I could sometimes get abstracts, but in 1997-98, I couldn't get access to the articles. I couldn't take what I had read in my university, my public university library, or Simon Fraser University's library, I couldn't take what I had read in those libraries and make it available to the public, even when it was about British Columbia, or when it was about Canada, or when it was about the world, for heaven's sakes. And at that point, I realized that the problem wasn't the public's interest. The problem wasn't journalists. The problem wasn't a sense that the research was too difficult to read or to understand or to interpret. The problem was something much more basic. And somebody this morning said, and it is hard to find to identify people here, somebody this morning in the Canadian Library Association said, it's not enough just to make it free. You have to provide support, and you have to assume that making it free isn't going to do the whole thing. And I agree with that. But the first thing is to make it available. And I wasn't able to do that in 1997-98. And it was the last, actually there was one more failure after that, but I won't go into that. It was the second last, the penultimate, the word I've always wanted to use in a talk like this, the penultimate experience for me in terms of saying the problem isn't where we have been attending to, and that is working with teachers and working with the public to improve their reading levels or to improve their interest in research or to improve the impact of the work that we're doing as scholars. The problem was with something as basic as access to publicly funded resources. Now, I don't need to take you through this. You know the argument. In fact, I see some of you are lip syncing along with me as I say it, and I find that very disrespectful. This is well known. In fact, it is amusing to me because when you do talk about open access, there are times when you speak to the converted. But never have I spoken to so many friends that are already converted. And so it is far too familiar. But those at that point, in 1997-98, 10 years ago, I realized that the problem had to be something other than the notion of teaching and education. And yet it was a notion of public education that seemed to be much more important. It got at the root of the idea that I hadn't quite faced. And that was, why are we teaching kids to read? What is so important about this facility with language? Is it only about employment? Is it only about the pleasure of reading Margaret Atwood? Could it also be about the pleasure of reading Northrop Frye on Margaret Atwood? Could it be about the thoughtfulness that Northrop Frye brought to the whole notion of teaching and literature and the importance of literature? And so at that point, I naively thought that I could reform or I could participate in a reform of scholarly publishing. And all it needed, heck, it's just so obvious, it just needed a project. We could just put together a project. And I wouldn't have to do a talk 10 years later because it would be done. I would do a talk maybe a month or 2 months or 6 months, not a month, but a year or two later. And so the result of this, though, has been a huge lesson. And that is that there were many people working on this issue, that I was not somehow the only one who had discovered this. And that each of the people who were working on this, some of them in this room right now, each of them working on this had come at it from a different angle. Had come at it, as Mary has suggested, from the sciences, where they have already done all of this, and where there has, as it were, a sense of co-development going on in the sciences and the humanities and the social sciences. If you take a little umbrage at the notion that it was done in the sciences and find that we had come around in a kind of patronizing way. But that's fine. It's not my vice president. It's not my university. We are partners in this, and part of the responsibility and respect, even of the illegal partners, is to be candid and honest with each other about this. So what happens in 10 years? And 10 years ago, well, actually, the journal itself, and many of you are very interested in open journal systems, and this conference is about many innovative systems, many innovative projects. But the one I'm responsible for, and the one that many of the people sitting didn't quite get good seats, Alec, I see back there, and Mark, and others, and Kevin, the one that, not just in the peanut gallery, I would use that cheap kind of comment, the one that, where it's been is the open journal system. So let me just a very brief bit of history in terms of the open journal systems, because I think we need to appreciate that. Open Journal Systems was launched in Newfoundland, in St. John's, in the farthest edge, in what is sometimes considered the periphery, but on the other hand, the very edge of the center of the empire, as it were, in terms of Canada's tradition and history. It was launched through a process of the five and a half hour delay between Newfoundland and here, that we used to great advantage. Because we were 5.5 hours from completing OJS when the launch was about to happen, and they worked through the night in a classic case, and we launched it then. In 2003, in April, and this is kind of odd to me, it took 3, 4, 5, 6 months for the first journal to launch. That seems like forever now. Because we're seeing them every day. In fact, Kevin has been inundating me with new titles in terms of what I'm just about to talk about. But in 2003, the Postcolonial Text was formed at Kwantlen College. Postcolonial Text is a remarkable journal. In 2003, it was a journal that had editors on three continents. It was a journal that has run since 2003 on what I would want to say, is a zero budget. But in fact, it's not a zero budget. Because in 2003, they paid $25 to a Sri Lankan artist for permission to use one of his paintings on the cover. And in 2005, they paid $60 for a student edition of Adobe Acrobat. Now, we're still under 100, which I think is a remarkable kind of credit in terms of postcolonial text. And Ranjini Mendes, who was not here, but is holding a distinguished conference on postcolonial literature in Vancouver, an international conference in a month's time. Ranjini Mendes has managed this journal with the help of volunteers at every level, three layers of copy editing, volunteer copy editors. She's drawn on a field of literature with global participation, so copy editing is good, the volunteer notion, it's not crowdsourcing quite, but it is a kind of volunteer, it's entirely a volunteer effort. Two layers of proofreading, peer review, so that was out of order, for those of you who attended OJS in an afternoon, would you please put that in the right order? Peer reviewing, poetry, creative writing, accomplished articles with illustrations, and a process of running a journal entirely for free, without the support of her institution, and without the support of any organization. This has become a critical factor in terms of open access, and one that I want to return to in a moment. But let me go from there, from that period of 2003 to today. It is my great pleasure today to announce, and I've been leaking this a bit, but we were holding on to this, and again, as a tribute to the statistical work of Kevin Stratton, I can announce today that we have 1,000 journals using OJS. actively using OJS. 1,000 journals, all right, based on software that was initially developed by undergraduate students, particularly Kevin Jameson, working at the ridiculous rate, I have to say this because I don't know how else to repay that initial team, at $15 an hour. There will be a court one day that I will have to face over this. I'm certain of it. But that they have been able to take a couple of ideas, a couple of concepts about how we could use software to manage workflow, to manage, as it were, the circulation of ideas within the journal, and then to greatly increase that circulation by publishing them online. And that initial crew of undergraduate students, again, I have no computer background. I had worked, fortunately, with a company called Knowledge Architecture in the 90s, run by Vivian Forsman. Knowledge Architecture was based on teaching students, high school students, project management. Teaching them project management so they could support the technology in their schools because nobody else was, except the technicians who visited every month on a Tuesday morning whether they needed technology support or not. And so we had students working on this technology and doing project management, and Vivian Forsman came from a company called Systems House, talking that in fact computers can be used for systems that will manage workflow. The kids all knew, the high school kids all knew how to fix anything. They knew nothing about how to manage a project, even less about how to manage people. And they were stunned, first of all, about how hard it is to teach teachers, and secondly, how much they learned when they tried to explain what they knew to other people. And out of that process of building systems for high school students with Knowledge Architecture and working with these undergraduates at the University of British Columbia in my pre-SFU days, as it were, we were able to put together a system that now has 1,000 journals. It's being used by 1,000 journals. Let me give you some of the stats on how this breaks down, some sense of this. One of the great contributions, and again, I have to slide back to Kevin Jameson again, because he explained to me, and this involves one of my favorite sort of anecdotes around Rowley Lorimer, the notion that the Canadian Journal of Communication was one of our early users, not as early as post-colonial text. And Rowley said that they were going to put in a subscription module into OJS. And at the time, I had resisted that notion, as you may recall, because I thought we were dedicated to open access. How could you put in a subscription model? And Rowley tried to explain to me the copy editing costs and a few other things with the professional running of the journal. But he was willing to create the code and contribute it. And I was still kind of resistant until I felt this kind of tug in the back of my coat. And Kevin Jameson pulled me aside. He was now in second year at university, and he said to me, you don't understand what open source is. Open source software means you have, as it were, released it. You have given it to the world to use and share and use it to whatever purpose they want. And that if it is truly open, you have to understand there will be a variety of models used. And that each of those models will contribute back to the open source, but will not dictate. He didn't quite use that phrase with me. But will not dictate how it will be used. And I thanked Kevin for that, and I went back to Rowley and shook his hand and said, great idea. And Rowley never misses an opportunity to mention that, in fact, he did create and contribute the subscription module, which is now a very sophisticated system. Thank you, Michael Feldman's contribution in this. And he did contribute in a way that reshaped the kind of direction and understanding around the use of it. So of these 1,000 journals, this open source community, the sustainability model that often comes up is based on the community contributions. So we have journals in 11 languages, going back to those post-colonial themes around the empire, the English language empire. And of those 11 languages, the first language that the journal was translated into was Turkish. And that seems just kind of a charming element to it. But I would go to conferences and I would talk about OJS and I would describe how it was available in English and Turkish. But since then, we have Croatian added as well. And we're working on Vietnamese and a number of other languages. As I say, there's 11 languages. I won't take you through the list of those. So as part of that development, we have 65% of the journals are in English. And if you know the story around journals, that's a high percentage. 14% are in Portuguese, but I think that number is wrong. Ramon is sitting at the back. Told me today there are 200 journals in Brazil that the unit that Ramon works with, IBICT, is supporting and helping use the materials. The journals in Brazil are often traveling to, in Spanish and in English and Portuguese. And so this idea that the system itself can support the multiplicity, the only, in fact, the only language that we have to pay some money to get translated, of course, Canada was French. And we had interesting discussions around the Parisian contribution and the Quebecois contributions in the language. So we have brought those two together in our version. But let me talk a bit more about the 1,000 journals. So the 1,000 journals, for those of you interested in terms of distribution, 46% are still using the original system we built, OJS-1, as we sometimes call it. And the sense that we built a system that people have been able to use this small. They change the oil every 1,000 miles, and they can get new tires, brakes they do, but the system is still trotting along. In terms of the journals, what we had first imagined was it would be new journals. But in fact, 46% of the journals using OJS, 46% of the journals are existing journals. Journals that have decided they need to go electronic. Because OJS is in the first instance. When I started the Public Knowledge Project in 97, 98, I hadn't thought about building software. I thought I would just convince people to convert to electronic open access journals. I thought I could use, and coming from my background in English literature, I thought I could use a thing called rhetoric, a thing called argument, evidence, prima facie cases, human rights. So naive. So naive. I had to build software. I had to answer the question, what would it cost to put a journal online? How much is it going to cost? What am I putting at risk by moving my journal online and by making my journal free? And the only way that I could legitimately answer that, well, I can tell you that, as I've repeated this many times, those of you who have heard me before, we did do research. I am a researcher, a social scientist, not a programmer. So I looked into the statistics, I looked into the economic figures, the statistics and results of people trying to assess the price of putting journals online. And what were the results of that? We did Larry Wolfson here, I would attribute, because he did the assessment of the figures and gathered them and we brought them together and we went from free, from zero, to a figure of $600,000 at Cornell University, and it's always been a treat for me that people at Cornell came up and corrected me. I'm not sure, it was $2 million. It was $2 million at Cornell University, and they came up and corrected me at one of the talks I gave and said, no, it was only $600,000, you're making us look bad. So I said, oh, that's great. Now my figures only stretch from zero to $600,000. And that as a social scientist, I could just sort of see my whole career flash before my eyes as we had spent a year analyzing the data and come up with very firm and reliable results that we could give to anyone with a great deal of conviction so that they could go forward to their dean and say, I can start an electronic journal, I can convert my journal to electronic basis now because Lipsky's done the research and the figures are in and it's very clear it will only cost between zero and $600,000. And so we realized at that point that there was no reason, and it's amazing to me. We don't know how many journals there are in the world. We don't know how much journals cost. We don't know how much peer review costs. And we are social scientists and scientists and humanities scholars. And all of this is kind of in the background. We know how Shakespeare spent his days. We're just not sure about how many journals are dedicated to theater and literature. So out of that experience, then, of trying to pin down, we came up with the notion that we had to create the software, that there had to be an alternative, and that the software itself, and this again is a lesson I learned from the undergraduate computer science students, had to be freely distributed. And while I thought that was a good idea, it certainly worked for Internet Explorer and Microsoft, it had to be more than that. It had to be open in its code, open to contributions, open to modifications, open to changes in philosophy and approaches in its use. And so we find that 46% of the people using OJS are using it as a source for existing journals. And that the oldest journal, one of the oldest, perhaps the oldest, but close to the oldest, the South African Medical Journal, continues to print, continues to sell its print copies, but has decided within the last year to make all of its electronic content free and to publish it at the same moment that it releases the print. And so the range of mixed models, the range of opportunities and explorations that do only one thing, that do not guarantee open access, but that guarantee an increase in access. And for me, that has become the critical moment. The notion that the efforts we're engaged in are not fixed on a single definition, a single model, but our focus instead on a large and grand principle, access to knowledge. And it was access to knowledge that I, as a teacher, as a school teacher in Sault Ste. Marie, and as a teacher of teachers, and you know what George Bernard Shaw thought of those who taught, and those who taught teachers, that I, in fact, was engaged in nothing else but in access to knowledge. And that, in fact, I was a teacher because of the pleasure of having access to knowledge. Let me finish with the stats here. I try to make stats a little more interesting with these anecdotal sidelights, because you want them just straight up on a PowerPoint slide and a table. No, not for me, please. 12% of the people using OJS, 12% of the journals using OJS are brand new, born digital, but only 12%. 18% of the journals, 18% of the journals are through our partnership with INAS. Sue Cummings is here in this room, I hope. Yes, Sue, it's back there. So we formed a partnership with INAS. It's a difficult acronym. It took me years to get right. It sounds kind of like a sting and a kind of combination of awkwardness. It's the International Network for the Availability of Scientific Publications. Oh, I'm so powerful. The International Network for Availability of Scientific Publications has been doing workshops on scholarly publishing, has been working in communities, has been negotiating very reduced, 95% in some cases, reduced prices for our libraries in developing countries. INAS is part of the reason why if you go to the University of Ghana in Legon and you ask them how many journals they have, and you look at the shelves, if the power is during the period of outage. And you were rather surprised when you're told it's 19,000 journals they have access to now in the University of Ghana. If there's any success story in the open access movement, it is through agencies like INAS that have negotiated those kinds of deals. Agencies like the World Health Organization that organized the Hanari Project. So the idea that the access to knowledge is an issue here, and that 18% of these journals have come through INAS initiatives, including the African Journals Online, which is the first of our collaborations, and Christo Captain is here. Oh, maybe not. Okay, I'm taking attendance. Okay, I only say that because I first met Christo's mother some years ago. And I'm keeping an eye on it. African Journals Online changed it, at least for me in terms of work we've been doing, changed our perspective, our relationship to Africa, and changed, I think, as it were, the profile of African journals as it moved. 230 and then 240 and now 270 journals online. Moved them online in a table of contents, some of them in their full text, some of them in their abstracts, and made them globally available. And so the open access movement has suffered to some degree from a center-periphery model where the entire focus has been on, not the entire focus, but a large focus, has been on freeing up, making available the knowledge that is at the center so it can be distributed more freely to the periphery. And one of the important points that Arun, I'm not seeing people here. Arun, are you here? You must be here. No. Okay. Arun, the scholar from Chennai in India, has made one of his articles that I read with my class not too long ago. But the heyday of Indian science was post-independence in the 50s and 60s, when they won their first Nobel Prize, and when the journals took exactly 3 months to arrive by boat. But what happened in those 3 months when they arrived by boat is that they received a large proportion of the literature for a reasonable fee. And that the 3 month delay that the ships caused did not prevent them from developing a science that was participated and engaged, as it were, on a global level to the point of the Nobel Prize. And then subsequently, in the 80s and 90s, with the increase in price of journals, with the proliferation of titles, they went to a situation where perhaps 10% of the libraries in India have anything like a minimal collection. And with a few outstanding institutions, like the Indian Institute of Science, and Thomas Abraham is here from representing Thomas Comfort. Thomas Abraham represents and has a very complete library and ability to offer to open access initiatives and the kind of collaborations that we've been working on. So what we're seeing then, in terms of access, is both a promise through the internet and a kind of interesting decline, an interesting kind of restriction. an artificial scarcity, if you like, an expression that we learned about recently. And I have a class here from UBC, where I'm just doing a little extra sideline lectures on it. Also, in terms of OJS, a number of journals are using us to manage archives. Okay, so that 5% of the journals using OJS are using it to provide a history, as it were, the backstory. And the idea that JSTOR, which provides back issues to year one, to 1665, and that OJS can be used on a much more cheaper basis, can be used, in fact, to provide, as it were, the whole history of a journal, increases the quality, contributes to the depth, allows us to keep, as it were, in life and in mind the history of the ideas that we're working with. And another element that sometimes gets lost in the open access movement is the notion that we are trying to contribute to the quality of knowledge, that it isn't only about free, now, immediately, 6 months, 12 months, 18, 24 months later. It is about how does this access contribute to the quality of knowledge. The journals are using OJS to create archives, using JSTOR is an excellent example of that. The economic model. Let me address that very briefly. Because we have been something of a success and something that we would have hoped and expected. In terms of publishing models, 49%, not 50, not 51. Kevin, you couldn't do massage these stats any better than that. You had to come in with 49%, rub it into my face. It's actually 48.7. Just like I wouldn't think he cooked the book. Kevin came back with 49% of the journals are using OJS to create open access. You understand my disappointment. 52% would have been fabulous. George Bush can win an entire country at 49%. I'm not satisfied with 49% because in Canada, that's not a majority. In Canada, you need more than 50% of the popular vote here. And in this case, open access. But the encouraging part, just so I wasn't crushed by this, is that 49% immediate open access, 40% are using OJS for delayed access, delayed open access, as we call it. He didn't calculate whether it was 6 or 12 or 18 months, but we're all hoping that it's 6 months and no more. So that 89%, it couldn't be 90%, 89% of the journals using OJS, 1,000 journals, you do the math, are using OJS to create open access, some form of open access, and are using it in combination with traditional models like print, that they are still selling subscriptions around, are using it in relationship to creating archives and putting their back issues online, are using it as a way to start new journals that didn't exist before, and that 11% of the journals are not charging subscriptions. 11% have not yet decided, have yet to publish their first issue, as it were. And so that we could not find a single journal that was entirely subscription-bound in the entire 1,000 journals using OJS. And this is a really encouraging element to the notion. And even though some, and CJC, I have to come back to you early on this, because CJC is one of the delayed open access journals. And so even though the subscription model is working, I assume, there's still a kind of compromise. In this case, entirely legal, in our partnership between Canadian Centre for Studies and Publishing and the Public Knowledge Project. So this idea then, that the possibility of creating, as it were, a more open and accessible road to knowledge is one that I would argue is about the quality of that knowledge. And the quality of that knowledge is very briefly now. I'm not teaching my class. But the quality of that knowledge is very much dependent on the ability to participate in the review and in the engagement and in the critique and in the taking up and building on that knowledge. And anything that places that on a global basis, anything that places it on that basis, contributes to its claim, contributes, as it were, to its quality. What I would argue to, as well as to its intellectual properties, but we won't get into the legal side of it. What disciplines are using OJS? Where is Mario? Does anyone have a cell number? 50% of the journals using OJS, and then this time Kevin, you came in. 50% of the journals using OJS are in the sciences. Very strong participation in Brazil in terms of the sciences. 23% of the journals using OJS are in the social sciences. 14% of the journals are in the humanities. And that might seem a bit low in the humanities. My own background is in the humanities and social sciences. But 14% of the journals using OJS in a field where what percentage of the journals are using any electronic form of support is a very encouraging number. But we are conspiring to change that and everywhere we can. 12% of the journals are interdisciplinary. If there was ever an encouraging sensibility, the ability to bring together disciplines within a single journal. And 1% of the journals, 1% of the journals are non-academic. Now this might seem odd to you because this system is free. You can download it. People are using it for all kinds of things. But the 1%, at the forefront of that 1%, is Gladstone Secondary School, 3 or 4 miles in about this direction. Gladstone Secondary School has published a peer-reviewed journal that, again, many of you may have heard me reference, but it's worth mentioning again, called The Pink Voice. They didn't Google search it before they used that title. It would have been a good idea. Some of you might imagine. The Pink Voice, a peer-reviewed, in my view, having worked in schools for decades and more, the first peer-reviewed high school journal. The peer reviews were done by the grade 9 students. The authors were in grade 8. The young women, it was all women who produced this journal, saw it as both a duty and a pleasure to engage in peer review of the grade 8 girls. The most exciting element in the Pink Voice for me was the change. I worked with this on Sarah Toomey, who's now at the University of Hawaii, was a graduate student at that time. And she was kind of disappointed because Sarah had a feel for the aesthetics of fashion. And they had a fashion section in year 1 of the journal. And in year 2, they dropped the fashion section and introduced philosophical musings. And I was delighted by this, given my background. The philosophical musings were very encouraging. You have a chance, look up the Pink Voice. Don't go to the first one on the top of the Google search. You have to work your way down a bit. I have to warn you, you're adults, but still. The Pink Voice, the philosophical musings, you open them, and they turn out to be poems. Poems about love. About love in high school. And the idea that these would be philosophical musings, and I had expected discussions of Wittgenstein and Wittgenstein's influence on Derrida, that kind of post-Habermasian world, we're frustrated by a notion that, in fact, of course, the origin of philosophy, not just in the love of wisdom, but in love, seemed to make perfect sense. They later introduced fashion, they weren't using it, but another fashion section as it went on. So OJS then, from 1,000 journals, it reaches a far and wide range. But I want to make clear to you, in the last part of this talk, that in fact OJS is a research project. I want to go back to the research side of things. Many of you are here around the technology. Many of you are interested in the role that the library can play. But the sustainability model for us, and this is an important element, how has this project, as it were, sustained itself for 10 years? Well, and largely through the partnership with Rowley and Lynn through the library and through the Canadian Center for Studies and Publishing. But it has sustained itself as a research project. And this is an important point because many of the journal developments we see are happening outside of the research community. And that if Stanford University has any claim in terms of publishing, and that is the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy, the origins of Creative Commons, High Wire Press, Public Library of Science, all came out of Stanford, but none of the people participating in those projects are involved in research on scholarly publishing. And so that's fortunate for me, because I've been lined up at the Mellon and MacArthur and other foundations, and there haven't been that many other people interested in doing research on scholarly publishing. So I want to briefly take you through. Mia, Clint, Rappaport, where are you? Mia? Oh, please. Mia and I just finished an article. Mia did OJS in the afternoon. Did anyone get OJS in the afternoon? Mia did a wonderful session. He and I did an article on the use of PubMed by massage therapists. It's kind of interesting, and chiropractors, and herbalists, but largely registered massage therapists. And in their use of PubMed, for those of you who don't know, is the largest medical life sciences, or life sciences index that provides access to abstracts, full text in some cases, run by the National Library of Medicine. And if you ever want a reliable spot for medical information, certainly medical research, Medline Plus for medical information, the PubMed, it's a kind of clever title, speaking of 10 years after. They were going to do Grateful Med as their title, that's just true, but they went to PubMed. And the idea of medical librarians, I mean, this kind of wit to me has always been a kind of charming point. But very briefly, I don't know if this is okay, but I wanted to share a little raw data with you. So, are we accepting that fine with people? Just a little bit of raw data. This is some of the interviews. One chiropractor in this case said, no one who has ever done research has ever done an abstract that exactly covers the detail of what's done inside. So when you actually read the research paper, you see more. The abstract never provides the robust, meaty quote I need. Now this is a point of revelation for us. This is the idea that chiropractors and massage therapists and herbalists, each with varying degrees of medical education, we're entirely frustrated by having abstract-only access. We're not prepared to judge, to take advantage of and utilize the research unless they have access to the full text. PubMed provides maybe 10-15% of the articles, 10-15% of the articles in PubMed provide full text access. If some people have the chance to do a little PubMed surfing, they come up green if you can go through and see them, which is a wonderful thing, and I hope to encourage Google to start indicating when articles, Google Scholar that is, when articles are open access. PubMed does that. But the massage therapists that we work with were repeatedly frustrated by this notion. They were able to find with great precision medical research, and we tried to steer them towards the complementary and alternative. Remember, there was a patronizing notion in terms of labels. The complementary and alternative medical practitioners area. They have a special search for complementary and alternative medicine. And they said, no, we want the research. We want to understand about disease, particularly as it relates to our areas of the spine, areas of musculature. And so this idea that they might be frustrated by that has been an important element to us. And we hope to begin to turn this corner around the notion of the lost value of having an entire industry. And in Vancouver, it is as strong as in any city of alternative and complementary medical practitioners. The idea of doctors complementing us, I think, should be more widespread than it is right now. But this ability to access medical research among a community that is contributing to the well-being of the country and of the city seems to be an important element. Second one I want to consider. I want to go through six very briefly, a little more briefly. Sarah Tooney, whom I mentioned a moment ago, when Blackstone and the Pink Boys, has recently done a study. She's just graduated and received a job, which is, to me, a remarkable and charming element to this work when it happens at the University of Hawaii. Did a study on professional development among teachers, going back to the very roots of the work that I had started with. She did an interesting project because we decided not to use any technology. We would create an artificial situation where we would provide the research to a reading group of teachers. And we would say to those teachers, this is about reading research. We'll find whatever you need. We'll bring it to you. We'll do the library work because you don't have access. We'll go to the UBC library. And I shouldn't say this because, in fact, it is illegal to take research out of the UBC library and give it to non-members. This is a violation of the contract with a number of publishers. But this is for research. This was an experiment. We had, as it were, informed consent, not from the publishers, unfortunately, or perhaps fortunately, but from the participants. A quote, a little bit of raw data from that study. I find reading and learning things its own reward, one teacher told Sarah out of the reading groups. I don't really want to go to professional journals and hunt through them for something I'm interested in, so in a way, you kind of provided us with things to read which are relevant to our interests. We do things like write letters to the Ministry of Education, so having information, solid research, that you can kind of use and think about while you're writing is much better than just saying, in my humble opinion. The notion that teachers could begin to independently, as it were, develop professionally, could begin to tap into resources and use them to mobilize or to, as it were, move the Ministry of Education in its decision-making. In a time of evidence-based policy, a time when people are increasingly accountable for what goes on in the classroom, seems to me a compelling notion. And although we skipped the technology in this study, We called it supported access, which meant that Sarah got in her car, drove to the library, photocopied the article. The teachers were deeply engaged in a range of issues related to their practice and were able to bring their experiences in the classroom to challenge some of the articles that Sarah brought to the reading group, to take some solace from them, to just be curious about them in terms of what they read. I have a couple of projects I want to report that are going to, as it were, report of, are going to be released. I want Smith, Esau, where Samuel Smith Esau didn't make it this evening. I'm not taking attendance, please. Samuel Smith Esau, as history brought back, and understandably maybe a little exhausted, from a series of workshops in Africa. Samuel Smith, as part of his doctoral research, has just finished delivering 7 workshops in 5 nations in Africa on increasing scholarly access to knowledge. Certainly OJS is part of it, but the more important aspect for us is doing research on the current state of the use of technology. Through AJOL, African Journals Online, we have a number of journals putting their abstracts and table of contents on the web. We don't have the majority. We only have a very small number of those journals that are putting their full text on the web. And so part of Smith's work was to do a kind of trade-off. You come to our workshop. I will teach you about these new technologies, but at the same time, I want to conduct a survey and see where we are, see how this works. In Brazil, Ramon is able to support 200 journals that are publishing electronically full text online from a single office with restricted means, and we want to understand if this is the way to work, if there need to be national centers of support. And so Smith's research has been based on a notion of trying to begin to assess. We have a similar project running in Latin America. Juan Pablo Alperin, who hasn't made it, it snowed. This is so lovely. This is my Al Gore moment. It snowed in Buenos Aires. I forget that song. But maybe tomorrow night we can give it a try. It snowed in Buenos Aires for the first time in 80 years when Juan was about to get on the airplane. Okay? It took that kind of climate change to prevent Juan from coming here. So Juan Alperin and Lucia Terra, are working, and Gustavo Fishman as well, who's currently in Rio, are working on a series of Latin American workshops. And again, from a sense of the workshop as a site for research, what is it that we are doing today with journals? How is the technology is helping and hindering? What are the challenges we're facing? And what do these new technologies look like? What could they possibly offer to us? It's part of the research initiatives of PKP for the years, for now and for the years to come. Finally, the notion of the reading environment itself. Finding a chance for me to go back to my day job. If my day job is teaching students how to read, what about reading online? What is the influence? What does it mean to begin reading online? 2 weeks ago, everybody who read an article pushed the print button first. Today, some people aren't pushing the print button anymore. It may be because of the environment. It may be because their students don't have access to the print. And it may be because reading online is becoming a way to stay connected. Reading online is a way to keep that knowledge connected, to check the references, to look, at the data, to download, blow up, explore, mash up the data that's available with the article. And so the notion that reading online has become a critical part of engaging with knowledge is another outcome of PKP's research. And Xianying Chang and Peter Arthur, I see very clearly here, Rick Kopeck has been a part of this. We are looking at developing a different kind of reading environment, one that says research will be read by people who have never read research before. It will be read by graduate students who are just beginning to read research, and most excitingly, it will be read by faculty members reading in a new area of research. And how do we build an environment? How do we create a space in which they can read further than they would have otherwise, that they can engage critically with the literature they're reading in a way that they couldn't otherwise? As a professor of education, and particularly a professor of literacy and technology, I know about reading levels. In the 80s and 90s, we had reading levels nailed. American public, average, 6.7. Canada, 7.2, grade 7.2. This community right here, I can do this, I'm a professional. 11.8, I don't want to name any names. Medical research, 14.6, grade level. And what did we discover? People from every walk of life, when someone is ill in their family, will read exceedingly above their so-called reading level. Will read, as it were, the highest, most difficult vocabulary. Will read in areas that they have no business reading, that no one had thought they would read. When PubMed started, PubMed was designed for researchers communicating with researchers. And then someone said, well, maybe we should let physicians have a look at the research literature. And other people said, why would they want to do that? And someone else said, they'll want to do it because we'll give continuing medical education credits for them, and they will keep their licenses. And they did. But what they didn't expect was a 100-fold increase when they put this information online for free. And that 100-fold increase that took place in the National Library of Medicine, and Al Gore did cut the ribbon on this, because, of course, he didn't invent the internet. Al Gore did cut the ribbon when the National Library of Medicine, or cut the cable, or whatever it was, the internet, on those reports, cut the cable on the release of the PubMed public, in a public forum, in a public way, make it available free, and the access to this information went up 100-fold. And so we have, as it were, these challenges around how we're going to create a new reading environment for a larger public. Educationally, it's a big challenge for me because it is a non-teaching model. Think about this. It takes some of the pressure off me, frankly. Because we've been taking a lot of heat around our ability to teach students to read. And it occurs to me that the demonstration, the evidence is there. People who we have failed to teach how to read have gone on and read when it is important to them, when it is vital to them. Gone on to read medical research, have gone on to read educational and legal and social welfare and human rights research and scholarship when it's been important to them. Not every day, but when it is important to them. So the idea that we might begin to create a new kind of reading environment, and that reading environment, we hope, the reading environment is the research that is being done. It's an environment in which you can annotate online, thanks to Rick and Xianning, in which you can begin to ask questions about how does this article relate to government policy. Show me the government policies from my government in Canada, from another jurisdiction, such as India. How does this research relate to government policy? Show me the media articles. Where was the media coverage on this? Show me the instructional materials that would help me teach this concept, this research, this information. And the idea that we can begin to turn this into a non-teaching environment, but in fact a self-teaching environment, so that our responsibility is not to teach every child by grade 12 how to read at a 14.2 reading level, whatever that means anymore, but that our responsibility is to design effective learning environments where people can take hold of issues that are important to them, that are of interest to them, that they are curious about, and discover what is known, and access that basic human right, and that is the right to know. And the idea that the university has failed up to this point to fully honor and respect people's right to know because they have failed to create an accessible body of knowledge. And there is a lovely multiplicity of meanings within the word accessible. Because accessible doesn't just mean open accessible. You didn't consider, Leslie, the term open accessible at the Budapest meeting? Jean Claude? Where's Jean Claude? The notion that accessible means multiple forms of access. It means it is accessible in a way that I can begin to understand. Accessible in a way that I can take hold of that knowledge. And I can use it, whether to confront the Ministry of Education, whether to provide solace to my family by understanding the progression of the disease, but I can take and use that knowledge, as it were, because I have an environment where I can understand through repeated contact He's seeing a concept used in multiple different ways by seeing it in terms of a newspaper story, a research article, a background piece. So the idea that, in fact, the educational climate that we're creating here, that we're contributing to in terms of the spirit of a public knowledge, is an educational climate. And the notion that this public education is going to be, for the first time, in some senses, on a global basis, and that participation in this public exchange is something that the university is going to be in the lead, is going to demonstrate leadership around, but that is going to do it on a basis not of center and periphery, as the university is a center and the community is seen as a periphery, not even on an equally accessible basis like the Woodward Building, where there will be classes taught in one room and there will be, as it were, inexpensive housing in another, but on the notion that as a university we need to be open, that we need to be accessible in multiple meanings of that word, that we don't need to dilute and we don't need, as it were, to write down or dumb down the work that we do. Because the work that we do is only valuable insofar as it does have that quality, that intellectual property of research and scholarship. But that we shouldn't prejudge, that we shouldn't decide in advance who should have access, who has earned the right, who has an adequate reading level to tap into this knowledge. What we need to say, very simply and very basically, is that people have the right to know what is known. They have the right to see that, in fact, what is known is not always as certain as we might imagine, that what is known is changing. People complain about the Wikipedia because one day it's this and the next day it's that. And Stephen Colbert can have a lot of fun with that. But I don't know about you, in my journals the same thing happens. It's not one day. But over the course of 2 or 3 years, what was once this is now that, whether it's in labels or in research findings or in evidence or in policy in fact. So this idea that we can begin to be a little more open about our work is the critical notion behind the Public Knowledge Project. The idea that we can be a little more open about the research that we do is a critical notion in the Public Knowledge Project. And what I want to suggest to you as a kind of final closing moment on this is that this isn't the new part. This isn't the innovation that Mario was referring to, that FFU is clearly the center and leadership in, and that UBC is exhausted and panting and trying to catch up with. Not any of that, no. The innovative part of this is not the openness to science. The openness of science is the consistent, is the constant here. And that the quality of science has always been about the degree to which it is open, and that what we are involved in a project like the Public Knowledge Project, is just an extension. In fact, there's a lovely play on the notion of extension, as the first outreach of the universities in the 19th century was based on a notion of extension and the extension courses, when people got on trains and left Oxford and Cambridge and went out and did, as it were, extension work in the community. The idea that we can extend the openness of research and scholarship is the basic principle. And that at the core of that, let me just come back to this final aspect, and that is the core of that is a principle of access. And that the projects that each of us is involved in, whether we're working on the commercial side of things or we're working on the public university side or the private sector, nonprofits or NGOs, the core principle for me is the ways, the multiple ways that we increase access. And I look forward tomorrow and on Friday to learning much more about your projects around these themes. Thank you very much. It would be such a crime and a shame if we didn't have a few questions from the representatives. But I would ask you all to keep your shoes on. Because I know that some of you remember that famous moment when Peter Khrushchev visited the United Nations. And Nixon earlier, no, in Kennedy years, and emphatically made his point by removing his shoe. The chair recognizes Rolly Lorimer's sandal, always laid back on Rolly Lorimer. So, questions that people would enjoy raising from the floor? First you raise your hand. I'm checking if this man sounds a bit. Then you turn on the light. I just turn on the light. Oh, yes.
It works, I think.
Well,
John, sorry, I'm Bobby Graham from the National Library of Australia. Your title was 10 years after. It was a terrific presentation. Thank you very much for that. Would you like to give us some sense of 10 years hence, perhaps looking into the future, and how you feel that might develop?
Yeah, I do have a section of the talk actually called Thanks for the 10 Years After, because it works, right? What you're asking me, what's going to happen 10 years after this? Yeah, so we're very consistent in terms of the title. There are elements that we have focused on for the next year or two, but it seems to me, I feel very comfortable saying a couple of things about 10 years after. One is that the print journal is going to be a rarity. I think I feel very comfortable saying that. And that open access will be a public and scholarly expectation. It won't be entirely the case, but what I think is the most encouraging element in terms of the wave of the future is that there is a rising public expectation of access. And that the notion of that access increasing quality, the quality of knowledge, and if you think about some of the recent scandals in science when peer review fails to detect serious, profound problems in research, the falsification of data in the case of cloning, that in fact it was a kind of public access among graduate students, albeit, but that it was the wide circulation of the materials that led to the detection of that. So the idea that the print journal, and again, I'm very sentimental about the book. It falls to somebody else to predict the end of the book in any means. And I was very fond. I am very fond. We have some lovely journals. The Harvard Education Review in my field is so carefully color-coded that after 10 years, you've got a decorator wall in your office. And I really did feel bad having to make a move. I recently made a move. And the Harvard Education Review, after 20 years, you know, really sets the tone for your office. And I had to turn. Because in the last 5 years, I haven't opened a single one. So I had used the Harvard Educational Review on a regular basis in my teaching because I went online. Because I cannot reach into those colors and say, oh, chartreuse. Yes, a chartreuse. When Henry Giroux published that article criticizing Joe Kinsler, well, yes, that was, I went online. And so the idea, and I meet graduate students who not only do their entire degree in their pajamas, which I find a little scary, but that are not using the library in the same way. So the idea of the print journal is, on the one hand, we can talk about those kind of technology things, but the more important element is this rising public expectation. And what we are going to do in the public schools, among teachers, is we are going to encourage and foster and nurture that expectation. And so that there will be a generation of some of your children who will say, why isn't it? How is it that I don't have access to this? What am I not a part of that I am not allowed to know what's been discovered? And that would be my safest and most encouraging element. Whether Elsevier will donate its entire content to the public domain for a tax write-off, I'm not so sure about. But publishing models have to change. There is an irrationality in current publishing models, current discrepancies in price that cannot be sustained. What that magic center, and again, a good center-perfect model, but that magic center economically will be delayed open access, mandated access, what it will be, I'm not sure of that. But I am certain that the amount of access will increase. And more importantly, it will increase as a response to public expectations, professional expectations, and I hope scholarly expectations. And we're going to develop the following technology. No, that's for a later meeting, isn't it? Yes. Yes, sir.
Thank you. My name is Ondari from Kenya. Thank you for that good speech. I don't know. What do you think about this so-called digital divide and promoting access to knowledge? How is it going to impact on it?
Yes. I mean, the digital divide is a very fair question. And it is a digital divide, but it is also an electricity divide. It is a power divide in terms of access to basic resources. My feeling on that is that, in fact, the digital divide is very real, but that we cannot wait until it is resolved to take action as scholars. That our responsibility in the scholarly community is to contribute to the pressure to reduce that divide. That the divisions that currently beset the world, all right, are not going to be changed easily or readily, but they are going to be changed as there is global pressure to do so. And my hope that increasing access to knowledge by making the work that we do available, it will give incentive and encouragement to that. And so what we have seen in some of the universities that we've worked with, and it's Kim and Charles, Kim, what a pleasure. Okay, Kim and I have worked together for a number of years, never met until this very moment, in Cameroon. And what we have found in Cameroon in the years that Kim and I have worked together, there was only internet cafe access when we first started our work. And the university did not provide any access. When we finished, this was in 2001, by 2003, there were satellite downlinks to the campuses that we worked at. And so there was an increase in technology that was happening rapidly. And what I felt at that time is that we weren't moving rapidly enough to provide the access that should result from that. So the digital divide, Helen, for me, is one of continuing pressure to reduce that divide and a continuing rationale for people to understand that the importance of that divide is about the exchange of knowledge and not just access to digital technologies. And our hope is that, in fact, that we will contribute in this form to some reduction. But again, the dilemma for me, just to go back to that, and again, it's not a question that I want to shy away from, but it's the notion of what can we do in terms of the work that we do as scholars, and the other side is when will it be time? Is there an order to these issues? And the resolution of the digital divide, as many other divides, it is as much an economic divide, as much an infrastructure divide, is one of continuing pressure. And this, to me, is in terms of public knowledge, is the biggest point that we can best apply. Thank you. You're thinking about the reception. Oh, no. Yes.
Yes, this is Dr. Bimal Guha from Dhaka, Bangladesh. Thank you for your nice and valuable presentation. You have said 1% of the journals are not academic. Which journals you have put into another academic category? This is school magazines, you mean?
It's a school, sorry?
1% journals are not academic.
Yes.
Which you mean?
They're not being used, Kevin Strang should explain this. But they're not being used as peer-reviewed academic journals. Now, it's true that the Pink Voice is peer-reviewed, but it was considered because of its philosophical leanings to be non-academic. We have journals, people have been using the system, Kevin, in my experience, have used the system as in classrooms, nothing more than a classroom, but they've also used the system to publish their own work as a portfolio to make available to publishers as a way of demonstrating their work. They have used the system as a basis, a kind of, as it were, cabinet, filing cabinet for their work. So that 1% is a small portion. Gothic, do you find the Gothic one? There's one for Gothic sources. That's a Gothic movement, trench coats and things. So it's used in alternative forms of publication. And we judge them as non-academic, that's unfair. If they're used for fiction, if they're used in school communities, is that it? Student newspapers. Yeah, so nothing to be ashamed of. If it's any of those words, I didn't mean to suggest that. Yes.
Cornelius, yeah, Cornelius Pushman from the University of Buffalo. Thank you for your very, very interesting talk. I have one slightly philosophical question regarding where we're going, not so much in concrete steps of what's happening with open access, but I keep wondering, as someone who uses digital texts a lot and who never really is felt very much at home in the print world, don't you think that the form of scholarly communication, or actually, don't you think that we're moving from publishing to scholarly communication in the sense that these forms that we're using, for example, the research article, that we're very much simulating these forms and emulating the forms of the print age in the digital age, but isn't that bound to change, and isn't that bound to morph into something new and different?
Now, and you're the first, Krina, especially that you asked that question. So the entire history of publishing is flashing before your eyes as one generation speaks to another. Of course. I mean, secretly, you know, the blog and the wiki is the future. And the idea that the journal article needs to be preserved above all else is, yeah. When the journal started, there was no journal article. No one knew what the standards were. When the first articles were published, no one said, check APA for your bibliographic references. And in fact, they were just letters. And the initial start of the journal on the basis of letters and the first word of Isaac Newton's only article, again, a point of great pleasure to me, I don't know about you, but the fact that many of us have Isaac Newton beat in the article count business is always a source of satisfaction to my mother. The idea that, and Newton, in his article on optics that he did contribute, the only one, starts with the word sir. And the first line makes reference to an earlier letter that he had sent to Henry Oldenburg, as Jean-Paul would know. That idea that the form is going to change is absolutely certain. What we're going to see dissolve first, and I didn't want to risk this with Bobby, but is we're going to see the dissolution of the journal. Certainly of issues, and then possibly of volumes. And it's going to go piece by piece. And I'm going to twinge a little bit, because I do have a kind of attachment to that. What's going to happen with the wiki and the blog as two kind of symptomatic, if you like, developments, I hope is going to be around the opening of science. I hope it's particularly going to be around the opening and immediacy of data and the sharing of methods. And so that future that you're pointing to is one that will be challenged and fought. And I'm grateful, Cornelius, that you're going to carry this fight forward for new forms. My secret has always been, and I can share it with you now because it's pretty well out, is that you must pretend that you're only changing one thing when you're trying to lead a revolution. That you must seem only to be concerned about something as simple as access. I just want to fix the access problem. It's just a simple project. Okay? But underneath all of that, when people say to me, well, what about peer review? Are you trying to destroy it? The publisher's lobby right now is saying that open access, open archive, not the open access mandates, will destroy peer review. And I'm ready to say, oh no, oh no. We have to, no, peer review, we don't. And so that ability to move. So you need to focus on these elements. And if there was a movement, and I should have addressed Bobby, is the relationship of data. The open access thing for me is done. We have established open access. It will be resisted. And as it is resisted, we know it is established. If Elsevier and the other publishers are mounting lobbies against open access, what does that mean? If they are investing millions into that, it means it's here. So we're done. Open data. The sharing and collaboration around the production of knowledge at its most basic. Now you've seen a recent demonstration of open data just a few minutes ago, and I shared that raw data with you without your consent, non-disclosures. I'll be at the door when you're leaving. So the challenge that we need to think about is what properties we want to maintain in this open data environment. What intellectual properties will contribute to the quality of that knowledge by opening it through means of immediacy of the wiki, the editability, the collaboration. The urgency of the blog. When Technorati will tell you how many minutes ago the most recent blog on that issue has been. Those elements are exciting. They speak to an acceleration, but an expansion of participation. The power of the blog today. And the scientists, and again, some of the students I'm working with are going to be looking, who's making, looking at some of the blogs in anthropology. The power of the blog in terms of Dan Rather's career, the power of the blog in terms of its ability to mobilize a kind of crowdsourcing of information hasn't yet fully hit the sciences and research and scholarship. And we need to begin to think about how that is going to happen. So yes, I would be as old as I am in a sense not to address that and to only focus on the journal. But I would be very appreciative and remain appreciative for people to continue to raise those questions. The wiki and the blog in terms of OJS is part of the, as it were, part of the integration. But I'm still working with a generation of scholars that say I can't leave the journal yet. I have to see this part through. And then I have to pass the mantle, as it were. Not just to you, but that's a good starting point. Thank you for the question. Yes?
I'm Nena from India. I'd like to thank John, first of all, for this live and pithy keynote address. Normally what happens is the keynote address, we start dozing off. But I think your keynote address cut through that jet lag of ours, and you're wide awake now. And
jet lag, I mean, I don't have to explain this to you, but it's known as jet lag.
Yeah, I know, jet lag, that's what I'm saying, jet
lag. But you're wide awake. But there were a few, I won't make any point
anymore.
Go ahead.
That person, she asked that question 10 years now, from 10 years from now. But don't you think in these last 10 years, we have this open access has, and knowledge leakage has led to a well-informed knowledge society?
The state of the knowledge society is an interesting one. The notion of a knowledge-based economy and an information age of information. And part of the motivation of this project has always been that the university has not been at the forefront of that. And if you take its current iterations, like evidence-based policy, which is a popular concept in India, but evidence-based policy and a whole range in education, we often talk about this, scientifically-based research and education, which is another concept that's very popular. And my sense is that this is part of a rising expectation, that we expect these things to happen too quickly. That we thought in 2001, when the Budapest Statement was released, we thought it would be only a matter of time before the light would be seen, and that open access, because it is such a clear case. But it doesn't, it seems reasonable to wait a number of years, or to expect a number of years to pass. And that the knowledge society will lead to an increased expectation. So my whole comments to Bobby about rising public expectations is the extension of that. And that the university has been exempt, even as it has been involved in social communities like the Woodward Building down the road, but it's building down that road and down up this road. Did you notice the business school right here in the financial capital of Vancouver has taken root? And so this idea that the knowledge economy, as it were, has led in this and that the university is catching up is disturbing to me. And the idea that we have been, as it were, part of that, a tower, part of a center, but not even a center in periphery, more like a fortress or a tower. Is a concern. And so I see our responsibility in working in university communities, as most of us do, but not all of us, but most of us do, and in working in public libraries, even more so in some of these, and I'm hoping that public libraries will be part of the rising lead, as it were, the rising public expectation. Because in some ways, just to finish on this theme, the public library has been the model for the public knowledge project. And the public library preceded the public school in the 19th century, at first, 1830s and 40s and through to the 1860s, the public library movement swept the English-speaking world. And then if you look at the history of the 1870s and 1890s, it was the public school. And the library is at the core of that. So, the knowledge society is here. And the last 10 years, the last 20 years, when did Drucker first talk about knowledge workers and knowledge societies? 1965. So we're 40 years after. That's not a great name for a band, though. 4 years of knowledge society, the university is beginning to see its role and responsibilities. And I want to suggest it's not too late because I'm historically lenient, but that it is certainly time. And I'm very encouraged to have this group, this global group, assembled here as part of, as it were, the vanguard of that. Thank you.
I was just wondering, we are so far talking about researchers and academics creating the knowledge. And what about the traditional knowledge? What responsibility do we have as librarians to kind of bring their knowledge forward and, you know, digitize it or make it more accessible? So far, they're not, they have not, only I think Dr. Greg Young, who's a First Nations person, has done a PhD at UBC, indicating that only 5% of their knowledge is actually rewarded, you know, the rewards go back to their communities. So what responsibility do we have as librarians who value access for everybody to actually bring them forward and have their knowledge be shared?
And that's a very good point in terms of the spirit of the talk around post-colonialism and the aftermath of imperialism. Because clearly I've been talking about university knowledge. I've been talking about traditional university knowledge. And I'm very sensitive, and perhaps not in my talk, but I'm very sensitive to that, the idea that in fact there's an indigenous, many indigenous bodies of knowledge that aren't traditionally included in terms of that university concept. And I think that your question in terms of framing it as an aspect of a librarian's responsibility, I think is very encouraging. The idea that we want to begin to understand the protocols of working with that knowledge, to understand, as it were, the interests of those communities that hold that knowledge in terms of accessibility, because it's not as straightforward, I feel, as the university in some ways, and again, that may be for me as an outsider. That we need to see the possibility of the university playing, again, a leadership role. And one of the points of pride at the University of British Columbia has been very much its role in work with indigenous knowledge. And so the possibility of the university is working, and again, the tradition in the universities has been very much to study Aboriginal communities, to work with indigenous peoples as a subject of research, as a point of investigation, as a kind of curiosity, anthropological or otherwise. And the idea that you're suggesting, that in fact we need to see what role we can play, how we can begin to understand the protocols of access and interests of those communities, would represent a major shift. And I think it's an important point to put on the floor. Thank you. But Fritz, I see you.
Lynn's looking at the...
I'm happy to sit down, please.
Well, thank you very, very much for this, and I know you've enlightened all of us, and you spoke earlier of the power of the spoken word, and we certainly saw the power of it this evening. When Lynn sent me an email early on and asked if the university would be interested in sponsoring some of the events here, I couldn't think of a more appropriate event for Athabasca University, and I will take an advertising moment to actually sponsor the following reception, and do keep asking John questions, because I know there are endless numbers of questions. Is there a time, Lynn? One more, a short one.
I can't promise that. John, I just wanted to hear your comment for a second, because there hasn't been a question on this. It seems to me that just your opinion, on the irony as we think about the public access of the last decade, at the same time that we've had increasing corporatization and the support of neoliberal types of agendas within the popular media. How do these two conflicting dynamics collide?
Just very briefly with the notion of the line in the author. I could just say that it goes back to Nana's point about the knowledge society. That what we've seen in the last decade, and Joe, it's a very good point to raise, what we've seen is a kind of contest around knowledge in terms of the privatization and commodification of that knowledge. And the universities, we've experienced this on a kind of lagged basis, that the Drucker writes about knowledge workers in 65. In 2005, our universities, as it were, have caught up and are putting increasing pressure on universities to, as it were, cost recovery, privatize elements of their delivery and services, and a similar kind of concentration in the media and corporatization. And so what I would position the Public Knowledge Project and the work that we've been doing, and many of you as well, is a contribution to the revitalization, if you like, or defense of the public sphere. And so rather than seeing this as a, as it were, as a takeover, I want to see it as a kind of balance, a kind of notion that the public sphere has been a vital part at different eras, at different times, and that the public sphere is under particular threat through corporate control of the media, a very good example, and that corporate concentration has been just as vehement in the field of scholarly publishing, where we have four major publishers now, controlling 30-40% of the journals, as it is among the mainstream media. What's been interesting going back to Cornelius' point is that the blog sphere has been one of the main challenges to them politically. And what I'm hoping is we can see a kind of parallel of the work that we're doing. And so the notion that the university is in the public service, and this is actually a phrase from NYU, New York University, is a private institution in the public service. The notion that we could defend that public sphere and to create within the public an expectation that this is a vital element in a right, without telling them that it's shot at Walmart, is to be an aspect of the kind of politics around this access to knowledge and the kind of political economy around this access to knowledge, with resemblances to Lenin and Marx, to Marx and Lenin, that one of my graduate students pointed out in class a week ago, is an interesting aspect of this, because it is a political economy. And in trying to pretend to change only one thing, I don't usually dwell on that element of it, but I think it should be clear to everyone. It certainly has been clear to the library community. The law is kind of defending the right of censorship, the right of access to knowledge, the right of public benefit. Is part of a political economy. So I'm not suggesting that we should be particularly hopeful at this point, but I am suggesting that there's a kind of vital element in terms of this struggle, and that the public sphere is at the heart of it. Thank you.
And I would add to that from my perspective that the revolution does not only start in what I call library land, it must start at a broader level of the universities as a whole, which allows me a segue into my advertising moment. Because Athabasca University, as Canada's open university, is dedicated to the removal of barriers of all kinds to learning and to knowledge. And those are barriers of geography, barriers of class, barriers of ethnicity, you name the barrier. When we develop policies at our university, one of the things that I always think of is this policy increasing a barrier or is it removing a barrier? And that's what we all have to think of in the kind of things that we do, is are we removing barriers to knowledge and to learning? And in Canada, if we think we are, we're not, because the participation rate in Canada, the OECD countries, is amongst the lowest. It's abysmal and it's not necessarily growing. So we have a lot to do. So yes, we should be proud of what we're doing, but there's an incredible amount to do at the university level as well. At Athabasca University, we have 37,000 students, and we have a very, very modest budget. Let's say as a modest in university terms, $100 million. One of the things that we got our Board of Governors to do is to say we have an obligation to public access to knowledge and information. And there's a minimum of 1% of our budget devoted to that. And you say, well, that's very small. Well, that's a lot quite further than others have done. If something like UBC or UT devoted 1%, just 1% of their budget to open access, there would be a revolution which Canada could lead. In fact, the reason that a small university like ours can do that and get away with it is no one else is doing it, so we can have a greater presence. So this last year with what we've done, and we'll be doing, we've constituted it, and we were at the alert of this year, is we've created Canada's first open access press, and we have its director here, and we have a senior editor here, and we have some of our technology people here, and we are dedicated to an open access press with all the bells and whistles and a few additional ones. As a radical university, and more radical than Simon Fraser, in fact, I was at a session where we were singing the International, and when is the last time you could lead a rousing rendition of that, and I don't sing well. We're as a university also dedicated to open source. When we decide to, for example, get a new learning management system, it's an open source system. Yes, there's a lot of debate, but we go open source. The other movement that we're leading right now internationally, and this goes beyond information and research, is open courseware movement. That is, yes, MIT has put its courses online, but they haven't embedded pedagogy. If there's a way of putting courseware online with embedded pedagogy that anyone in the world can use and contribute to, so it's truly open, that is, I believe, the revolution of the future. And where the resistance is, the resistance will be with the middle classes and the institutions that rely on accreditation. I mean, that is so important to them and their existence. So I hope the revolution proceeds, but I think it will take some time. And I hope that in a small way, a small university like Athabasca University, which is growing faster than most others, so there are people who are following and want to lead, there is a future in the open access, the open source, the open courseware movement, and in the open university movement, of which designate ourselves as Canada's open university. But with that being said, I wish you to enjoy yourself at the reception following. I hope that the wine is now also open, as with the food and the bar. So go and enjoy yourselves, and I'm sure John would be quite willing to engage in any conversations, as I know he will in the next hour or so. So do enjoy yourselves, and we were delighted to host this reception this evening.